from the Gothic Quarter in Barcelona. This is Market Movers, the podcast that gives you a closer look at the financial markets to trade responsibly. Here are your hosts, Lior Cohen and Yochai Elam.
Hello and welcome, and thank you for joining us for Market Movers, and thank you for spreading the good word and subscribing to our podcast. It's much appreciated. I'm your co-host, Lior Cohen, and joining me, he hasn't stopped IMing since he found out that there's a royal baby on the way, Yochai Elam. How are you doing, Yochai?
Hi, Lior. I'm doing great here in Barcelona. The sun is still shining, and the news of the royal baby from across the channel, well... I think I missed that out. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Okay. We're going to talk about today about the relationship between gold and inflation. Is there a relationship, and what's up ahead for gold? Also, we'll talk about the Scottish referendum and the next FOMC meeting. But first, let's kick it off with gold and inflation.
They found gold at Sutter's Mill.
Gold?
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 When we talk about gold, obviously most people think about, okay, it's another safe haven investments against the inflation. Does it really come up to be a safe haven in your point of view?
Well, it doesn't have any yield, so if there is inflation, you don't get anything back in return. Just rely on the price of gold to continue rising. And if there is inflation and too much money printed all over the world, people expect the price of gold to go up. Well, but that isn't always the case, is it?
Yeah, that's the thing. I know that a lot of people bought gold, or at least that's my guess, at least, that especially after the economic crisis of 2008, suddenly we saw a sudden sharp rise in gold prices and reaching almost to the 1900s, and and people even suspected that gold prices couldn't go all the way to $2,000 per ounce.
Yeah, it wasn't that far away, but it stopped there.
Yes, that's true. It stopped there, and it collapsed in 2000, the beginning of 2003, all the way down to around 1400, 1300, and ever since then, it's been around 1300. It hasn't done much ever since. The questions we'll try to answer is, first, does gold protect you from inflation? Is it a safe haven? And what could we expect from the rise? How can we explain the rise and fall of gold prices in the past couple of years or so? And of course, what is next for gold? So when we talk about protection from inflation, I think for one thing, people talk about that when they talk about inflation, they talk about first and foremost the state of the economy and how the Fed implements its monetary policy. For that, as you well know, Yochai, the Fed has done implemented a lot of steps in order to jumpstart the economy. If we'll see in the coming months that the Fed will start to pull back, as it does now with tapering QE3 and maybe raising the rates, and we'll talk about that later in the show about the FOMC's next meeting, the logical conclusion is that thus the fear of inflation will dissipate a little bit and gold prices will fall back down. So for one thing, I think that the old notion of gold being a hedge against inflation, I think it started off roughly in the 70s with the oil crisis and the embargo of the Arab nations in OPEC. And back then, if you hold on to your hat, oil prices soared from $3 per barrel to $12 by March of 74. Yes, $12. Ludicrous, right? So with that coincided also the rally of other commodities. There was copper, there was gold, thus considered more of a safe haven, especially after the additional crisis of 79 with Iran, which led to a sharp rise in inflation numbers. Back then, the inflation rose to, in 1980, it was in 13.5%.
The United States.
Yes, in the United States, 1980, and 1979 was 11%. And with that coincided the rise of gold. Back then, it rose from, in 77, it was around $148 per ounce. And in 1980, it reached $673 back in September of 1980.
Wow.
Even though it's still less than half than what it is now, it's still a sharp rise in 1 year, in 79, from 79 to 78, the average annual price rose from $306 to $612. So that's double the money in 1 year because, for one thing, people saw there's a rise in inflation, so everybody jumped into gold, and voila, we have a sharp rise in gold price.
Yeah, much more than the rise of inflation at the time.
Yes, so that's another point, and I'll get to it right in a minute, but that's another point about, is it a hedge? So yeah, so you can understand that it's not a hedge. Just finishing this thought that the rise was so staggering, and following the Fed's monetary steps of raising the long-term interest rates, yes, they raised them, the short-term interest rates, excuse me, which obviously exceeded to long-term interest rates, raised it up to the level of 19 to 20% back in May 1980. We saw a sudden collapse of the gold prices. They fell all the way down to, in 95, it went all the way down to $317. So you can understand that when we talk about a hedge, what do you want from a hedge? You want, one, to protect, to correspond with the risk involved. So in this case, we want the risk of the money devaluing, and also to be equally volatile. And in this case, gold is number one. It's very volatile, as you can see it back from the 80s, and also now in the recent years, until 2013 at least, you saw it was very volatile. And for one thing, it's not corresponding with the rise in inflation. If inflation goes up by 10% in a year, you want an asset to cover you by 10%. If it goes by 20%, okay, you made money, but it's not a hedge anymore. It's not a safe haven. It's just...
Yeah, it's just buying like any other stock or any other financial speculation.
Exactly. I mean, for all intents and purposes, if you want that kind of a hedge, then buy a company that follows inflation. For instance, you can buy the big retailers, if it's Walmart or other similar companies that, you know, their prices go up and thus also their revenue and thus also their asset, the stock price, and they correspond and much more similarly to the rise in inflation. Or, of course, American U.S. Treasury bonds. That's also something that follows inflation. How do you think about gold as a safe haven, though? Yochai, what's your input on that?
Well, in ancient times, and I think also now in areas of conflict, if you have physical gold, it's a safe haven because it'll always be worth something. So if you need to flee, it's also relatively easy to take gold, diamonds, other precious metals. But so it's a great hedge if you don't believe in the system at all. I guess physical gold. But if you don't believe in the system, why would you buy ETFs or mining stocks or anything gold related and not the actual physical thing?
Yes, that's an interesting point. And if you don't believe in the system, then who would to say that you will can fall back on the CME and their system as well, because that's also part of the system. So there's that, and of course, if you go to Rick Perry, he still believes that Bernanke is literally an enemy of the state with what he has done in recent years with the QE program. So there are people who do believe that we'll have just a rising inflation right around the corner. So there's that. Do you think if we see about the rise of gold prices in the past few years from 2007 till 2013 or so, do you think it was driven by a fear of inflation or just because we had a crisis or any other factor they think corresponded to this turn of events?
So basically, after the global financial crisis, the United States, the United Kingdom, Japan, and perhaps other central banks began printing money, basically wanting to lower long-term interest rates and help the economy. But this money also spilled to other places such as stocks and commodities. And it, of course, contributed to the rise in the price of gold. But I think that most of the rise in the price of gold has been speculation from gold bugs who grabbed media attention and the rising prices, which accelerated more money, pushed more money into gold. So it looks like more of a speculation. And at some point when the money stopped pouring in, when the music stopped, basically the price of gold began falling. The taper tantrum was one of these points, but not the only one. I see it less as a hedge against inflation, which never came, and more of a speculation that went one way and then went the other way. Some other traders went short and made a lot of money on the fall as well.
Yes, so you more of the idea that it's a speculation over a fear of a sudden rise in inflation then?
Yeah, all the people talking about hyperinflation, the Weimar Republic, Zimbabwe, I think they went really, really, really too far because inflation never appeared. And households in the United States and Europe and other places were deleveraging all the debt they had. So despite all this money floating around, nobody wanted to take on more debt. So even though the banks have so much money, they don't have who to lend it to. And the banks themselves are they're getting better, but they weren't in such a good state, let's call it that way, after the global financial crisis. So basically, all this money creating never triggered inflation. It still might trigger higher inflation than countries want, maybe 5-6% if things get out of control. But for a hyperinflation environment, for a hyperinflation event, we need a big political event and not only printing of money by the central bank.
Yes, so I also think that it's more about speculation and speculation over a sudden eruption of inflation, even though, as you said, we saw the Fed pumping cash into the system, and if you look at the money base, it did rise very substantially in the past few years. But when you look at M1, M2, or the inflation rates, as usual, you see that it's still very low, and when between the 2-3% at the most in the past few years. So you didn't see a sudden rise in inflation, even though the Fed has been printing more money and trying to expand and jumpstart the economy. There is another interesting theory. I don't subscribe to it by fully, but I still think it's worth examining by economist Paul Krugman. And he tried to use a basic hoteling model for commodities, which is originally model for oil, natural gas, but he used it, you know, he kind of jammed it into a gold and tried to explain the rise, and to a certain extent you can also explain the sudden drop in gold prices. The idea is that gold tends to disappear over time until they reach one day the so-called choke price at which a flow of demand goes to zero because there's no more gold left, so it disappears into the teeth, your additional electronics. So now we have to ask, okay, so what's the trajectory of? So it's based on the flow of demand. As demand rises, we see also a rise in the price, and steady and slow rise. The drop in real interest rates back in 2010 and 11 drove higher the demand over a short period of time, and that's what we saw also, a sudden sharp rise in gold prices due to the low interest rates of bullion enthusiasts that didn't need a price appreciation to hoard gold. So it's basically, in other words, the alternative price of holding gold dropped, so people stocked up on the yellow metal and delayed the consumption of gold for the future. This theory needs to consider gold as a consumed commodity such as oil, natural gas. So if without that, it doesn't reach the choke price, and thus it falls apart. But it could partly explain the sharp rise in gold prices and gold hold, which is due to rise in gold holdings over a short period of time, and then remaining steady. And it also explains that back in 2013, to a certain extent, we saw a sudden jump in long-term interest rates, which more or less corresponded with the sudden drop in gold prices, because we saw a sudden rise in gold in long-term interest rates, prices, and thus contracted back to the 1300s. And since then, remained pretty stable. And on the other hand, the long-term interest rates also started to contract again very steadily. In a way, it does explain it, but not fully. But it's a nice, I think it's a nice little theory to consider. Looking forward, what's up ahead? So for one thing, we saw that by the end of August, the CME lowered its benchmark for margin for gold contracts
because of the drop in volatility. No.
Yes, exactly. Because what they do is pretty simple. Back in 2013, for instance, or in 2010, when there was a sudden sharp rises in volatility, the CME just pulled right in and raised the the margins, and suddenly we saw a sudden drop in gold prices. It was very eminent also for silver, dropped from the high 30s all the way down to the low 20s. It does have a very sharp effect. It doesn't have effect, on the other hand, when it's the other way around, because, okay, so people can buy more and need less margins, but it doesn't mean that everybody will just jump in. They do jump out when they have a margin call and they need to... when they have a higher margin, so they have to cover their bets. We only see usually this reaction from the other way around. But it may have had also a little bit of a positive impact on gold prices, because it remained pretty stable in August, in the few and in recent weeks. So we have that to consider, and we also have what's up ahead for the Fed. And we'll get into the next FOMC meeting pretty soon, but I'll just mention that in any case, if you take into consideration Krugman's theory or our theory that it's mostly about the fear and inflation that never came into fruition, in either case, we see that the Fed plays a significant role in the direction of gold. And if the Fed will continue to be more hawkish and taper down its QE programs, which we know it does, and also raise interest rates next year, then it doesn't vote well for gold, and we could see a further contraction in gold prices. And where could it go? I don't know. I don't think it will remain at 1300s next year. I think it will go even lower than that, but we'll just have to see what's up ahead for that.
Brothers and sisters are natural enemies, like Englishmen and Scots, or Welshmen and Scots, or Japanese and Scots, or Scots and other Scots. Damn Scots! They ruined Scotland!
You Scots sure are a contentious people.
You just made an enemy for life!
We have to go back to Scotland, and we have a very big news item next week. We have the big referendum, and the polls show that it's pretty close, right, Johan?
Yeah. So what we had with Scotland up to now, everybody knew about this referendum for 2-3 years or so, but everybody was sure that it's going to be a no vote, and it was sort of on the back burner, the 18th of September. And suddenly in the past week and a half or so, the polls began getting closer. And the peak was when a YouGov poll and over the weekend showed a very, very marginal lead for the Yes campaign. So that triggered a weekend gap in sterling, which has recovered a bit since then, but hasn't closed the gap. And the Scottish referendum news, it just takes over any trade. It grabs the headlines, and it's the only game in town. It managed to sideline Mark Carney, the governor of the BOE. That's the only show in town until September 18th.
Okay, and I mentioned the polls. Where are we at when we talk about the close? I heard it's very close, but yeah. What's up ahead for that?
Well, the most important poll company is YouGov, and they showed a 2% lead for the Yes campaign, but that takes out all the people who are undecided, and it's too close to call. That's within the error margin zone. So another poll of Servation showed a 6% lead for the no campaign, which is steady with their poll in August. That means there's no change, there's no momentum in the last few weeks. But also these guys don't show an absolute majority of 50%. The most important poll remains, as I said, YouGov, and they publish last poll on September 17th, and I think perhaps over the weekend. It depends on who commissions them to do what. Anyway, any poll published in the UK is the only game in town. It's very close to call, and every poll makes a difference.
Very well, and besides that, what there is more to consider when it comes to the referendum? What's on the agenda?
Okay, basically there are lots of known unknowns and unknown unknowns in the Scottish theme. If Scotland becomes an independent country, will there be border crossings? Probably not. That's not the main issue, but how dependent will Scotland be on the oil? Will it be part of the EU or not? How much time will it take it to apply for a membership in NATO or not? How will it turn UK politics? And will it adopt the pound? Will it do sterilization or something like that? Can there be a currency union or not? All these issues are supposed to be debated in the 18 months leading from the referendum to the independence declaration, somewhere in the spring of 2016. But anyway, it's all this uncertainty. There's the Royal Bank of Scotland as well, domiciled at the moment in Edinburgh, but it said that it would probably move to London in a case of independence. All these issues, when they become open, when the uncertainty becomes real, they move the markets. But as we can see from the bookies, most think that Scots will vote no. One of the main reasons for that is that many people are still undecided, and people who are undecided usually decide no, because they don't want to change the status quo. They're actually scared to have an opinion, and in the end, they'll be scared to make a change. And I also think that'll be the case.
You gotta love the status quo, huh? That's what everybody like. Just keep it calm waters and prevail, and that's it.
Yeah, keep calm and carry on, as the Brits say. Yeah, so maybe Scotland deserves more from the UK, and I hope they'll feel that they're treated fairly. But I think a majority doesn't want a material change into the unknown, into independence. And I think that's also priced in. Beforehand, we had certainty that there will be a no, and now we have a bit more of uncertainty, so the pound did fall quite a bit. If we do have, as I expect, a no vote, the pound has room to rise about 2, 3, 4 cents against the US dollar, which is quite considerable. But in case there's a yes vote, I think we could see a fall of 10 cents, maybe 12 cents. I mean, 1,000 pips, that could be huge, because this is not even partially priced in. And all the unknown issues for the UK, political uncertainty, for example, UK goes to elections in 2015, just before Scottish independence. So if Scots vote for the UK Parliament and less than a year afterwards they leave, that's a constitutional crisis as well. So there are so many issues on the agenda that, and when this became an open question, every poll makes a difference, but the real poll is on September 18th. The polls close at 10 p.m. local time. That's actually 8 GMT.
So it's going to be a very exciting exciting day, that's for sure, for the British pound either way. Basically, that's what you're saying. So there's that. And speaking about the currencies, I know it's still a very unknown issue when it comes to if they'll take the euro, if they'll stay with the sterling, if they'll hijack the sterling until they'll come up with their own currency or peg it to this, to the pound. But I think that, for one thing, if people are more concerned that if they'll if they won't form their own currency, they'll just stick with the pound, I don't think it's going to be such a bad thing for them, considering that they have such a very wide relationship with England, and also the economies are pretty similar, so it won't be just like Europe embracing the European Union embracing its own currency, and because the economy and the language is pretty different when it comes to Spain and to to Germany and to France. That's very different economies, and they have a different language. And language is also one barrier for exchanging of work, to work. Also, it's one of the main barriers. So there won't be such a problem. Well, you know, to a certain extent, if British can understand Scots, that's another another issue. There's another issue there. The whole story about that, but. If it's still a matter of just because they have similar economies, pretty similar, and also they have the same language, so it won't be such an issue, just as the euro embraced, the European Union embraced its own currency. It will be just as if Texas has its own currency, has the same currency as California. So there is that. I don't think they'll have much of an added value, except of course maybe doing a little bit more fine tuning for their own economy and forming their own central bank, and thus they have more control over the monetary policy as well. But I think if they'll have more influence in the Bank of England, then that'll be more than enough to compensate and have more influence instead of just forming their own currency. But as you said, it's pretty unknown, so we'll leave the Donald Rumsfeld-like answer a question mark of, we'll have still unknown unknowns, which is good for the markets, right?
We've seen an upswing in volatility in the recent week and a half or so, since the beginning of September, and many thanks to Mario Draghi from the ECB, which we've talked about in length last week, but also thanks to the Scottish referendum, and luckily for us, we'll have at least one more week of this speculation of these wild swings.
One more week of wild swings. Wow, that sounds like a good weekend in Vegas. Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll have to remember that. And speaking of wild things in Vegas, we have to go back to Washington, and we have the FOMC meeting next week. So what's up ahead in our docket when it comes to the Fed?
It's an FOMC meeting with fresh forecasts from the Fed members and a press conference from Janet Yellen. So this will be more interesting than the previous one. The statement will be eyed, the forecasts with the dot chart around regarding future interest rates will be eyed, and of course every word that Yellen says will be closely watched.
So we know that they're going to take about another taper, right? And they're going to end it in October, right? That's what we know for sure.
So actually it's the last taper, and it's accompanied with the press conference. The Fed is about to tape for the seventh time, from $25 to $15 billion dollars of monthly purchases. That's certain, and QE is going to end in October. We already heard that quite clearly from the Fed, and recent data hasn't altered that view whatsoever. The big question remains, when will interest rates rise? To that question, the Fed has always answered, a considerable time after QE ends. What is a considerable time? Markets still think it's around June, around mid-2015. These expectations moved to March, when Yellen said something about 6 months, and then she retracted that, so it went back to mid-2015. Some speculate, given the recent hawkish FOMC meeting minutes, that the Fed will drop the wording considerable time at this meeting in September. But I don't think it'll happen, and the reason is the data. Since the last FOMC meeting back in July, the one without a press conference, we had the unemployment rate staying around the same levels. It's at 6.1%. It sort of played around 6.1%, 6.2%. It's good, but it didn't further advance. It didn't continue the very strong momentum. It just stayed in relatively low levels. So it's not good enough. It's not enough to strengthen the hawks on the FOMC. Of course, another reason is other job figures, and the recent three job figures are not that exciting. The non-farm payrolls for August, it could be a one-time, but it's still only 142,000 jobs gained. The second thing is stagnation in the JALTS figure, which rose very, very sharply and very nicely, but it stalled at around 4.67. And the Fed eyes this as well. And also jobless claims, which already fell to the lowest level since 2006, but since then have gone up, and they currently stand at the time of our recording at 315,000. Yet again, the general picture is the economy is doing great, but it hasn't further advanced very significantly since the last meeting. So it allows the Fed more breathing room. I believe the Fed will acknowledge the improvement in the U.S. economy. It will say once again that QE is going to end. And we probably will not get any hints or any thing regarding the interest rates. There'll still be a considerable time after QE ends. And QE ends only in October, so we will not hear about that from Yellen now in September.
All right, so Your point is that we won't see any big headlines from this upcoming meeting. And yeah, I think also she'll still be much more cautious, especially such since the economy is, as you said, it's doing well, but it's not progressing so substantially. It's still in a very fragile point where if it will even hint of a rising rates or put much more emphasis about turning more hawkish, it could contract the recent progress that it had, and maybe even and we'll might even see a little bit more people freezing up, and the economy maybe taking a little bit more of a turn. So the economy, as you said, is doing much better than it did a few years back, but still has more way to go. And the Fed doesn't gain much by now revealing its hand about taking the next step and raising interest rates, especially since the economy, it has more room to grow. It's still pretty fragile. So we'll have to see where it goes with that. So, and also when it comes to the reaction, I think at least for gold and silver, we might see another decline in prices. That's what happened in the past. Since October, except for one time back in June, where it was more of the Fed revised down its outlook and brought a little bit more of a hints about maybe not pulling the trigger of raising interest rates, did a little bit more of that, then gold prices jumped back up. But besides that, since October, gold prices pretty much soon after the decision was made, gold prices declined by between 1% to all the way to 5% back in October. So we'll probably see another, we won't see such a strong reaction, but we could see another a fall of around 1% in prices as it will be again as it was in the past few meetings, where spinning the wheel and saying a lot of words without actually saying and not committing to anything, but in the meantime still tapering and still taking the measures in order to bring it closer to more hawkish steps up ahead.
Yeah, Yellen has a tendency, since apart from that meeting back in March, She makes the best effort she can not to rock the boat, and I think it'll happen again this time as well.
All right. It'll be interesting to see how this turn of events will come to fruition. Okay, so that's it for today. Thank you as usual, Yochai.
Thanks, Lior. It's exciting times in the markets, and hang on.
Yes, we'll hang on to your hats, and we're having a bumping ride next week. Thank you all for listening. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions, then drop us a line at our website at forexcrunch.com and tradingenergy.com, or seek us out on Twitter, and we may refer to your comments or questions in the next show. If you like our podcast, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes, subscribe via newsletter, iTunes, or any option that tickle you funny, and spread the good word. That's it. Until next time. This is Lior signing off for Yochai, saying have a great week and invest responsibly.
For comments, suggestions, and questions, visit the podcast page at forexcrunch.com or tradingnrg.com, where you can also find past episodes and subscribe to the show. Our listeners make market movers possible.